From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Oral History Special number 5. Our veterans who served in one of the three women's auxiliary services during World War II are always proud of their particular branch, and WAF Daphne Canning is no exception. When Oral History Officer Jonathan Byrne interviewed her in 2017, she was still proud to have worn her Sparks badge, the insignia of a Royal Air Force wireless operator. These Oral History Specials allow us to bring you the complete recordings of interviews we've previously featured only as much shorter versions. And in this episode, Daphne, who volunteered at 17 and a half, tells us about becoming a wireless operator, then later a Morse slip reader, and also how she survived being hit by a V1 rocket. You're really getting three for the price of one, because Daphne also tells us the stories of her father and her husband, all three of them linked not just as family, but as wireless operators helping the Codebreakers at Bletchley Park.
Today, it is Wednesday, the 31st of May, 2017. I'm Jonathan Byrne from the Bletchley Park Trust, and I'm delighted to be interviewing Mrs. Daphne Canning, formerly Tucker. And here with me is also Fiona Jenkins from Bletchley Park and Daphne's daughter, Gail. If we start with what you were doing before you joined the WAFs.
Well, I left school when I was 14 and went to a secretarial college in London. It was Pitman's College. And learnt shorthand and typing and business procedure. And then I finished there in 1942 and went to work in a solicitor's office in London in Lincoln's Inn Fields. I went there for 9 months. During that time, I was 17 and a half, and I went to the Air Ministry offices in Holborn to volunteer for the WAF, and they asked me what I would like to do. Well, I had already had a little bit of knowledge about Morse communications, and so I thought I'd be a wireless operator, my father being one already. So December 42, I was called up just before I was 18 and went to, place in Gloucestershire where you kitted out and everything.
Innsworth,
that's right. And then I went to, the wireless operating. I'm bloated if I can remember the name of the place. In Gloucestershire.
Is it Compton Bassett?
That's it. I went to Compton Bassett for 6 months. And when I finished there, I was posted to Hendon, where I was a wireless operator. I was a bit bored with it because I only had to do weather reports, which were all figures, and it's only twice a day, and it seemed to me I was wasting my time. We had a paper would come through every so often about other things we could do, and one of them included this Morse slip reading, learning it in London. So I thought, I'll go there. So I volunteered for that. I started in January 1944, I went to it was either number 7 or number 1 radio school in the Science Museum in London. All the exhibits had been taken away and it had been divided into small classrooms for various things. The Morse slip reading was in one classroom, and I don't think there were very many of us there. I don't think it was a very big sort of trade. Because I had been a shorthand typist, it was a great advantage to me because I didn't have to learn to type. So really, I was a bit, bit bored with that because a lot of it meant you had to type because you had to type the Morse as it came through on a slip and you typed it onto a typewriter. So I finished that in the June. I could have done it much more quickly, really, but, you had to follow the whole course through. So I went on weekend pass to my parents in London, in Wembley, where we live. And when we got back, I was due to be posted on the following Monday. I got back on Sunday morning. And that night, a doodle bug blew us up. So we were all rather delayed. I had an injury to my arm, and the billets were really demolished. I don't know whether that's ever been recorded.
It has, actually. I'm very interesting. You mentioned that. I wondered whether the same one. And it was the accommodation that was hit, wasn't it?
Yes, our accommodation.
What was the name of that?
Thurlow Court in Kensington.
Because a few years ago, another lady wrote in, because she was in the same, she was also affected by it.
Yeah.
And she wrote in asking if I could give us some more details about what happened and who was hurt. And I was able to find out some information in the National Archives, but didn't have the list of who was injured.
I know one lady was killed. That was Corporal Padbury. I always remember her name, Padbury. Don't remember her Christian name. She had a little room opposite my room that I was in with another two girls. And she was killed, but I don't really know in what way was she injured, because it was dark and we couldn't see each other. Everything was confusion and you didn't know what was happening, really. We were all more or less, the shock was a bit like zombies, really. We were on the third floor of the flats. The three floors above us were vacant because they considered they were too dangerous. But anything below that, I don't really know. I can't tell you very much about that. It's just that they couldn't get us out because of all the rubble in the road. The fire engines, of course, are not like the present day ones, and they couldn't get us out. So I do remember the centre of the flats was a stairway with a lift in the centre of the flats. And of course, the lift hadn't been used and the stairs were demolished. And the firemen, I remember, they put ladders over the gaps. And I can remember having to walk down the steps going forward, if you can, instead of like backwards like you do on a ladder, because it was more or less at a slope, but not a very steep slope. It was a sort of a semi-level slope, difficult to explain. Yeah. And I remember the fireman lying across the gap and putting his hand up to give me some balance to walk across this gap. But I can't remember anything else. I mean, I know it was all dark, not completely dark, obviously, because otherwise we wouldn't have seen what we were doing, and the smell and everything. The girl in the room with me, one of them, she said, oh, I must get my fags out. And I said, oh, for goodness sake, can't you smell the gas? Because all the gas fittings had been ruptured. And I said, can't you smell the gas? It'll blow us up. And the other girl had her bed below the window, and her face, when I saw her in the light, little fragments of glass, just little red pits. Oh, it looked dreadful, poor girl. But I don't think she was in any actual pain, because I think we were all too shocked to know what we were doing, really. I know, unwittingly, I think, I don't know why I did it, but one girl started to scream, and it's the first time in my life when I've ever sworn. I said, shut that bloody noise! And she did shut up, actually, and there was silence after that. But I can't think I've ever spoken like that before.
There was no warning, I guess.
No. You just heard these doodle bugs came along and the engine stopped. And I just knew that that was going to be for us. And I was lying in my bed, and most of them, I suppose, were asleep because it was during the night. And I can remember pulling the bedclothes up to my ears and just waiting. There was that terrible sort of... And then this terrible noise. A blessing, I think I got my ears covered, because otherwise I'd have got blast in my ears. And then silence. It was amazing, really, after that terrible noise. And then this silence. And you say, Are you all right, Valerie? I can remember because the girl's name was Valerie. You all right? Yes, I'm okay. And then I can't remember the other girl's name. Are you all right? Oh, no, she said, my arm, oh, it's all wet. Well, there was nothing we could do about it. And then we were got out, like I said, down the stair, the ladder. I'm sorry, this is a bit jumbled, isn't it?
Did they then take you somewhere to hospital?
We went to some sort of, I think it was a church hall where we were sorted out. Anybody who was really badly injured, of course, was kept. But if you were all right, if you could breathe and stand up, you were all right, you see.
Yes.
And I really don't remember that very much. All I remember, I was told, oh, well, you can go home for 2 weeks. So I went to my home, my mother's home, and this must have been the Monday morning, but I can't remember going home. I'd got no clothes. I was in my pyjamas, and I don't know whether I'd got shoes on. I can't remember because, I mean, obviously, we weren't so badly demolished that we were aware of where we were. The middle walls had fallen, but the outside walls of the building were all right. Where the floor of our rooms were, that's the solid still. They were well-built flats. And I think I might have found my shoes beside my bed, as they would have been. So I probably put them on because I can't remember having bare feet when I went down the ladder. And, I mean, when glass and everything about the floor, you would get glass in your feet. So I did have a lot of glass in my head. It took a long time for it to come out because, of course, everywhere else was hidden on my tummy with my face.
They said take a couple of weeks off, but you then had to get all your uniforms sorted
out. Well, this is it. Well, somehow I was given some uniform. I cannot remember anything about it except that it didn't fit me. I had a skirt too long and a jacket too tight. And the hat, of course, you know, when you had your new hats, they were like a chef's hat. And you had to damp them and put them flat and, you know, hope that they would then flatten down and look more like a cap. And no badge. And so my hat was like a chef's hat. What I looked like, I have no idea. Well, I don't know. I just went home on the train. And I remember I opened the back door of the kitchen, my mother's house, and my mother looked up, good gracious, what are you doing here? Because I'd only just left. And I said, we've been bombed. And I shrieked with laughter. Well, it was shock, really. Yeah. But my mother thought it was a joke, and she'd never realised just how bad it was. She and my father did go and look at the building after the war, and she said, I'd no idea it was so bad, you know, because I'd laugh. It was shock, really. Yeah. But I stayed at home for 2 weeks, and then I had a letter to report to Leighton Buzzard, which I did. And from Leighton Buzzard, they sent me to Chicksands Priory. And that was my start at Chicksands Priory. When I went to the B site, the A site was the interception site. I'm never really actually told that, but I knew it was. That's where my father had been. But he wasn't there at the time because he was in hospital as a result of his experiences. So I was sent to B site, and that was the more slip reading site. Now, I mean, I had no idea what we were doing. I just did my job of more slip reading, which I liked very much. It was very interesting. Of course, we were very busy, kept busy all the time. And I have no idea where our terminals were, except that eventually my husband was sent to India. He was originally going to the East because he'd got a tropical kit. But that's another story. He went to Delhi in the end, and he was on the, I think it was the Central Signal Centre, something like that. And this was a bit naughty, really, because they were testing radio teleprinters. Teleprinters were all landline at the time. And they were testing them for radio because it would be much quicker. general teleprinters, they had to jump places to get to their destination because the signal wouldn't get far enough. But for radio teleprinter, the signal will get further and they didn't have to make so many jumps.
So they'd relay it from point to point, the signal.
They're trying to relay it, So they were testing it. Well, now, in order to test these communications, they had to get a frequency, and that's my frequency I'm having, and I'm using it all the time. So it had to be used all the time, otherwise somebody else would pinch it.
Yeah.
So the engineers would be taking it in turns to test it, and when they wanted to have a rest, because they were glad to have somebody else who would take over, so my husband offered to take over when he discovered the terminal was Chicksands Priory, one of the terms. So if we could do that on our off-duty, not off-duty, but when we were having a quiet time or a bit of recreation, when I was at work, I could talk to him.
Sure. But wouldn't operators chat anyway, just as...
Well, they would, but it had to be the official operator, not somebody who was, just giving somebody a bit of time off. So the operator was quite pleased if my husband said, I'll talk to her. It was only occasionally when it happened that we were on duty at the same time. So I've admitted to something that...
I'm sure you'll be all right.
You'll be all right. So, I mean, I think I'm past being punished for that now, aren't I? I was there until 1946, but we were still busy, even... In 1946, we were very busy, so I don't know what happened about the radio teleprinters, whether they were a success or not. Of course, then, what was it to be about 10 years later, they started satellites, and so there was no need for a radio teleprinters. They'd got the satellite. Yeah. Whether they ever had them or not, I don't know. But I was there until 1946, and then my husband came home in 1946, and I was discharged in December 1946, and we were married in 1947.
So it's quite a long time after the war. You were still
still working very hard.
You said earlier on that you were already interested in Morse. Had you learned Morse?
No, I hadn't learned it so much as the fact that Father had been in the Air Force in the First World War. He'd been an observer in the aeroplanes, and they had to know Morse for that. And I was in the guides, and we had to learn more. We didn't have to learn Morse, but I was just, because of the connection, I was quite interested. And so I did a little bit of dot, dash, dash, dot, and things like that. But you don't say that. You say da-da, da-da, da-da. So we did a little bit, and I just got the interest. And so that's what made me decide to do it, really. I had no other interest, really, about it. And now, when I was a little girl, about 10, I think it would have been, my mother was very interested in history and anything history. And she said to me one day, she said, come in here and listen to this, because she said, this is history. She said, this is the first broadcast from America to England. And I don't know who it was speaking, whether it was the president or not, I don't know. I can't even remember what he said, but I do remember. So that is what I listened to. And I think that's the forerunner of all the present-day radio.
Yes. At Hendon, the signals you were dealing with, you were receiving the
more. Yeah, I was receiving the weather reports, and that's all I was doing. Yeah. And it wasn't a very busy station. It was ATA, Air Transport Auxiliary. I think it was mainly the planes which were ready for delivery would be taken to Hendon and then be flown off to wherever they were supposed to go. I don't really know, because we didn't seem to see much in the way of aeroplanes. Four girls were posted to Hendon. Two of them went in with the flying control, where they were in connection with the planes.
Oh, yes, traffic controls.
Traffic control, that's right. And I and another girl were on shifts in the WT room. And again, only taking weather reports. And to me, it was wasting my time. I was losing all my speed. I'd got no practice going, and I thought, well, this is no good to me. I can't do with this. So that's when I found this notice came through, and I thought, well, I'll go in for this. I shan't stay here.
Can you say a little bit more about more slip reading? The only reason I ask is because I don't really understand it, and certainly anyone much younger than me, it's such a, yes, a remote technology.
That's right.
Compared to what we're used to now.
A lot of people say, I'm saying Morse lip reading. I'm not. It's slip reading, MSR. You have a big typewriter which types and also will make a strip of about an inch, maybe not as much as an inch, of perforated paper, perforated slip. It has a center line of holes which goes round a cog, and that's to move the paper along. And then the Morse, the letter, for instance, A, dit da, a dit is two little holes above each other, but a da is a hole at an angle. So that's dit da, you read that as A. So B is da, dit, dit, dit. And that goes through on the paper as you type.
So it's the paper going past in front of you and you're reading it off?
Well, you type it first. You have your message, yeah, and you're typing it. And all while you're typing, this little strip of paper is coming out of the machine. And when you've finished it, you roll it up into a little figure of eight and hang it up for the next person to take. And he will then put that on the transmitter. The transmitter is quite a small thing, just runs through, and it's transmitting all this Morse. And the person the other end is getting the Morse coming through on a little tape, but a little needle which is going up and down, and a dot, dit, is a little point, and a da is a line. And so you read that off as it comes through. You have to stick it onto some paper. One person could do it, of course, but you don't have time for that. You have one to type the slip, one to put it through the transmitter, one to receive it, the other end, and to stick it onto a sheet. You have a little thing that it goes through with glue, and you just slip it as quickly as you can. And then that goes through to the teleprinters or goes through to the routing office, and they read off what the directions are for where it should go. They didn't know the messages, but they had to know the signals of where it got to go. So they all had books as to say, ABC goes to, oh, that goes to Henlow, or FJK goes off to Air Ministry. They had to route it to wherever they had to go. But they never read the message because they probably wouldn't have time anyway. So that would have been gone through on the teleprinters probably to wherever it had to go. And it seemed to me it was a lot of people wanted to do, a lot of actions wanted for one message, but it still was considered quicker and, of course, easier because it was radio.
Yeah. The thing with Morse is it always gets through in very bad conditions because it's either a dot or a dash or a space.
Yes.
Whereas if it's voice, you can't hear it.
That is true. Yes, that is
quite a bad phone line. You know,
yes. Does that explain?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Were you dealing with messages coming in, going out, both?
Both. Yeah. With everything. Mm. Yes. We just took it in turn to do different messages because, you'd get a bit fed up with doing the same thing all the time. I wasn't very keen on doing the transmissions because once you'd sent the message off, you had to finish it off by hand, da-da-da-da-da. I felt that I wasn't confident enough to do it properly.
So if a message was going out, you put the slip in the machine and it was sent.
Yes.
And you'd have a bit of Morse at the beginning and end just to sort of make contact and say goodbye.
Yes, yeah. I can't remember the procedure now, but you say one more or two more messages to come.
And would you type this up yourself onto the slip?
No, I think you just use that by hand.
Yeah. Would one person type the slip up, somebody else send it?
Yeah.
You'd sort of share the work.
Oh, yes.
And would you move around?
Move around, yes, that's right. I mean, if you didn't want to do a particular job, there was always somebody else who would do it. I wasn't very keen on doing the hand signals. I would prefer to do the typing and the... it was because I was more familiar with typing, so I suppose.
When a message came in, how did you deal with that? Did you have to type it into letters?
Well, you brought the message in through on the paper and you stuck it onto this form. Then you would type the message out, yes. You read it and type it onto a paper.
And what was in the messages?
Were they... It was all in code. You didn't know. Nobody ever told us what we were doing. We never really inquired. There were about four channels, four or five or even six, I can't remember, in this room. Each one was connected to a different terminal.
Can you remember where they were going to and from?
No, not at all. We did think that one of them was the front line in the invasion because it was so busy.
Yeah.
And they might have even had two channels. But I don't know. I do wonder if another one wasn't America.
Did you have any knowledge of the place called Bletchley Park?
Well, I knew Bletchley Park. I knew of it. I did get stranded in London once on leave. I was going back to Chicksands and I found when I went to get the train, it had been, I don't know, damaged or not running.
Yeah.
And I went to the traffic office, as they had always in the mainline stations. They always had a traffic officer. And I said, well, I'm stranded. As long as you did that, you were safe. Otherwise, if you arrived back late, you were on a charge. So, as I say, I went to the traffic office and said, well, I'm stuck. How do I get back? And he arranged for me to go to Bedford and from Bedford to go to Bletchley. He arranged for me to stay the night at Bletchley and I had breakfast there and I was taken by the dispatch rider. In his motorbike, he had a sidecar, and I was taken in his sidecar to Chicksands.
Worth it.
Yes, I was okay because I, you know, I'd done the proper procedure.
Good. I'm sort of slightly putting questions to you that.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I think I know what the answers might be, but it's really just to get the picture. Did you have any idea of this code-breaking thing that was going on?
Well, yes, I did. Ah. I just don't know how I knew. Because I tell you, I was sitting at the breakfast table and everybody was there in the mess, you know, we were all in the same boat. And there was these two girls, like myself, I suppose. They were busy chattering away and I was couldn't help but hear what they were saying. And they were talking about their work. And I thought, this isn't right. This shouldn't be. They shouldn't be talking like this. Because me being nosy and I said to them, excuse me, but do you realise that you shouldn't be talking like this? I said, you don't know who I am and I could be anybody and I hear everything you're saying. And they looked a little bit dumbfounded. But anyway, they stopped talking then. And I mean, that's I did know it was secret. Yeah. I did know what they were doing. But never occurred to me to mention anything anyway. Mm. I never thought about it. I don't know. It just didn't come to me. Anyway, these two, I felt a bit embarrassed because I'd been a bit pompous, I think. But on the other hand, I felt, well, they shouldn't be talking like this. They didn't know who I was. I could have been a usurper because I wasn't one of the station. I could have been anybody. I was in my uniform, of course, but didn't matter. And I got my sparks up, so I was all right. But I mean, if somebody wanted to get into anywhere, there'd be no difficulty, I think, for them. I had no difficulty getting into Bletchley Park. I showed my pass.
Was that the RAF camp just outside? Was it Church Green?
Well,
you were only there for one night, so you probably
I don't really know. I know it was part of Bletchley Park, and they were talking about what they were doing.
Oh, I see.
And, and I knew jolly well what they were saying. So it just seemed to me that they shouldn't have been talking like that. And I think I was quite right, except that I wasn't normally a pompous sort of interfering nosy body. But
that's quite interesting because. I mean, generally, people say they didn't talk about their work. Well, they must have, particularly if they were, you know, in their own mess or something.
Yeah.
And I suppose you were at, you know, to you, an unfamiliar camp.
Yeah.
And they probably assumed everybody around them was in the, doing the same thing.
Well, they wouldn't
them.
Have known no, so they, each other.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, yeah, so they probably forgot, yeah.
It wasn't really a busy
And I suppose because you had your Sparks badge on, they probably thought you worked, because there were a lot of WAFs at Bletchley Park itself.
Oh, yes.
So they probably thought you were one of them.
They're probably, yes. My proudest possession with my Sparks. Yes. And it always makes me cross when I see people on the television, you know, where they're making a film about the Air Force. They've got two Sparks and that's wrong. Only one lot.
Well, thank you very much. That was very useful about more slip reading because, you know, we think everyone will understand it because they're interested in Bletchley Park. But, of course, a lot of these things, you know, we have to explain. Like teleprinters, you know, I'm old enough to have used one, but they're a long time ago now. I often ask people to explain what a teleprinter is.
Yes, yes. I cannot do any of this typing like on my daughter on a keyboard.
Yeah.
I can't type because my fingers are too heavy.
The keyboard's very small on a laptop.
Yes, they keep. And you just need a little flick. Mm. I can't do that. I press. They need a great thump. So it's very difficult to. Well, I can't type. I get a succession of letters. Mm. So there we are.
Where do you live when you're at Chick Sands?
Oh, well, at Chick Sands, first of all, we were too many of us and we had to go to Rest Park. They had an extension there, a camp there. The whole place was owned by an insurance company and they used it as a holiday area for their employees. Yeah. But, of course, during the war, I suppose, they went out there for safety, I think. But anyway, these huts in the grounds were taken over by the Air Force. I think there must have been about a dozen huts. They all had about five or six separate little rooms each side of the huts. And we all had our own little room, which was very nice. But it was only just enough room for one bed and to put your clothes and some hooks and that. Well, you didn't need much anyway. You'd only got uniform, or you should only have uniform. And we had a cookhouse where we had our breakfast and meals there. And I should think that there were only, I don't know, maybe there'd be about 60 girls there, maybe, I suppose, between 60 and 100. But we're not there always at the same time because we were on different watches. We did a four-watch system. You do 8 hours a day, morning, noon and night, and then you change over one so that you were off for a weekend. Or the way it worked out in the rotation, it was quite a reasonable system. It was quite good when it came to sleeping because during the daytime, if you've been on duty at night, we were taken by transport from Rest Park to Chick Sands every day. And it was quite nice for sleeping because you didn't get so much noise. Mm. But then eventually we did transfer to Chick Sands itself and Chick Sands was beautiful. It had an avenue of beautiful lime trees and it was very warm. It must have been 45. It was a lovely warm summer and we had these Nissen huts in Chick Sands and I can remember on the top of the hill and the sun on these lime trees was absolutely wonderful. Mm. The scent, and I can remember that so much. It was so beautiful. And we used to take our beds outside sometimes so that we could sleep outside. Mm. But it was nice and warm and sunny.
Yeah.
I don't think that went for very long, actually. But when you remember something so strongly, you feel as though you've did it for a long time, but you didn't. I think probably only the odd few weeks. But anyway, we were up then at Chick Sands probably for the last year or so. But it was nice at Rest Park too. Yeah. Lovely gardens, lovely walks in the area. But wherever we went, I thought it was nice anyway.
And when you had some spare time, what did you...
Well, we were not very close to any town or anywhere. Of course, I'd met my husband when I went to Chick Sands, first of all. Oh. He'd already been there for 3 months. He had been to the Science Museum and done his course as a slip reader. And he was already on duty and I just met him. That was it.
All right.
So we used to do a lot. We used to go into Luton because my husband's very keen on music. And I remember one day he wanted to go to a performance of, some bit highbrow for me because I'm not a very musical person. And we went to this performance in Luton Church. I can't remember what it was. But anyway.
Classical music, was it?
Yes, classical music. Yeah. He liked it. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid I didn't, but I went and stuck it. And he had to make an excuse to go out. And he didn't like to come back because he was a bit embarrassed at walking back in front of the people. So I was left there. Where did you leave me there on my own? He said, I'm sorry, I had to go. So I was left listening to something that wasn't really appealing to me. Anyway, that's a little sideline.
He missed it.
But we used to go into Bedford.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite nice. And what else did we do? Well, they had camp dances and things like that. And we seemed to find, things to do. We used to walk a lot in the country. Yeah. We liked walking.
So you didn't do what I've heard some girls used to at the time, is you didn't go to dances at the American bases or anything like that?
No, we didn't. Well, I wasn't very impressed with the Americans, to be honest. They were too loud and so cocky. I didn't like that very much. So I did once or twice when we were stationed in London. I went to one or two of the forces clubs because we had some wonderful things in London. Yeah. It was a marvellous place to be because we got free tickets to go to the shows and we've had a lovely time. I remember some of the wonderful theatres had been turned into forces clubs, Shaftesbury Theatre especially, and that was lovely. That was a sort of nightclub, but that was a sort of forces club. We used to go there. That was in London, of course.
Yeah.
But when it comes to what else we did, well, in London, I suppose we were very lucky because we did have so much to do. I remember we used to go to Lion's Corner House where you could get a meal there for a very low price and have as much as you liked because it was all off ration. Mm. And, of course, you were very greedy. Mm. You ate stuff yourself.
Why not?
But it was wonderful food. I don't know how they managed it, actually, but it was very nice. Mm. We get a lot of forces went there.
Yeah.
But going back to Chicksands, there weren't many Americans round about, were there? I don't know.
No, I think there were more the other side of Bedford.
Yes, I think so, yes. Yeah. They didn't appeal to me very much.
Oh. Anyway, you met your husband. So we've got to get him on the roll of honour.
Yes.
What was his first name?
Ronald.
Ronald. I'll make sure he's on as well.
Oh, thank you.
So he was more operator like you, more slippery.
Just the same. Very similar experience, really. Started off as a wireless operator, but he did go straight forward and do more slip reading.
Yeah. So he was at Chicksands before you?
Yes. He must have gone to Chicksands in January 1944.
You said he went out to India.
And then he went to India in, he didn't know where he was going, actually. Can I show you something?
Yeah.
Would you be kind enough to get me the tin? Yeah. All his kit was tropical. Mm. They were all given some cigarettes.
Tin of cigarettes.
Yeah.
Woodbines.
Yeah. Well, just out of curiosity, he kept the tin.
Yes.
Just for memorabilia, really. Now, if you open it, I did this. He never opened. Well, he had all the cigarettes, and that was that. Well, I was very curious.
Get the card out.
And I said, "Oh, it's got a lining. Take out the lining."
Yeah. Be careful.
Oh, there it is.
That's it. And there's something else there. Have a look at that.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't know that was there.
There's banknotes.
Yes.
Japanese.
The Japanese government 1 cent.
Yeah, and I could only think that they were given to them for bribes or I don't know.
Yeah.
But why is it written in English?
It could be, say, in Burma, the Japanese were occupying. They produced currency and produced in English because maybe that's
what people would understand, yes. Or maybe it was for when they conquered India.
He didn't know. It was a surprise to him.
Yeah.
And this was a long time after.
So he didn't put them there. They were there when he opened
Yes, that was all there.
Wow.
When I opened it, I think it might have been years after.
He didn't smoke, obviously, himself.
He smoked. He smoked the cigarette.
Smoked the cigarette. Oh, I see.
Yes,
left the lining.
But left the lining, didn't bother about it, you see. But he thought, I'll keep the tin, a bit of memorabilia. Never know, it might come in handy for something. I kept it and he didn't know it was there, obviously. And I think he was destined, really, to go out to that area. But the bomb was dropped.
Yeah.
And so while he was on the journey going out, they were redirected to New Delhi. So he didn't know that they weren't going to go to wherever they were going. Mm. They went to New Delhi instead, and he became a more slip reader in New Delhi, and that's where he went, and that's where he stayed until he came home, was demobbed in 1946.
And your father?
Well, my father's quite a story, actually.
Okay.
Sit back and listen.
Can we have his name first, please?
Vincent George Tucker.
VGT1.
Vincent George Tucker. Right. Thanks.
And he was born in 1899. So he volunteered for the Air Force. Well, it wasn't the Air Force.
Hmm.
1915 he volunteered and put his age up a year, as a lot of them did.
Yeah.
And he went into the airships. He was an observer. Of course, they transferred from the airships to the aeroplanes, and they had to know Morse for that. So, of course, before the last war, I think when Chamberlain came waving his paper saying there'd be no war, they knew jolly well there was going to be a war, so they were preparing. They realised they hadn't got enough wireless operators, so I think they must have somehow put an advertisement in before the war in 1937 or 38 for people with a knowledge of Morse, because he volunteered and he went into what was called the Civilian Wireless Reserve, CWR. Mm. I seem to remember he had a bit of a badge or something. Can't really remember. I was not all that old, but I was interested. So I think this is only supposition. But I think Air Minister used to send out radio messages for CWR people to presumably send back as practice messages to see their accuracy. Because the week before war was actually declared, he was called up. Well, he was 40, 41 then. He really shouldn't have gone because he was considered too old. But because he had this knowledge, he went. He was posted straight out to France.
He was in the Royal Air Force.
He was called up, yes, to the Air Force as a wireless operator. And he went straight out to France with a band of other men. And I've got their photographs here. I don't know whether he was in charge or what. There were only a few of them. Can't remember how many exactly, but I think that's all there were, half a dozen of them. And they went out to northern France, to Breteuil. I think they were doing interception then.
Gosh.
I'm pretty sure that's what they were doing. But again, I can't say that definitely, but there was no other reason for them to be out there. And they were doing this until Dunkirk. Mm. And of course, when the Germans overran France, he and his men were told to burn everything, and they couldn't get to Dunkirk, of course, because the Germans are between them. So they had to make their way down to this place down south. And, I don't know if you ever see some of these war films, you see the masses of people making their way down the main road to the southern France, and the boats were coming across to pick up those people to be taken back to England. Mm. But he never talked about this, but it must have been a terrible job for him doing this long, long walk. I mean, from northern France to southern France, but it must have been terrible. And of course, my mother didn't hear from him for about 2 months because he was having to walk all this way. But you see these pictures of the refugees, masses of them were carrying their bags and things. And he was one of them, obviously. He got to Saint-Nazaire, and then he had to wait in a queue for a boat. And the boat came along. No, you can't get on no more. And that was the boat where the bomb went down the funnel and blew the boat up. And he was all right. He didn't go in at that boat. Was very lucky. But the next one he was able to get in. And he went to somewhere up north when he got into England. I mean, again, I don't know how he got from the boat up to...
Would it be Cheadle?
Cheadle, that's it, Cheadle Hume. And again, I don't know what happened, but it definitely went from Cheadle to Chicksands, that's right. And he eventually got a commission, and then he was a signals officer at Chicksands. And I've got a photograph. There is a photograph of him in the signals section.
Oh, cool. Did you ever come across him at Chicksands?
Yes, so, yes, yes, that's it. That's the photograph.
Wow. So that's a great photo of loads of RAF, a few WAF officers in front of Chicksands Priory, 26th of August, 42.
Yeah.
Gosh. So where's he?
Do you know which he is?
Oh, yeah, there he is. I was working my way through the names. There he is. Yeah.
No, yes. I was looking for the names as well. Oh, there he is, yeah.
Yes. If he's not already, he will be on the Roll of Honour very soon. In fact, all these people should be.
I don't know whether they are or not. I really don't
Well, I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I reckon most of us probably a bit old, perhaps, to still be with us now, and whether they or they're in the past, whether they'd made contact.
Well, I mean, most of them, I should think, are dead by now. Yeah. Well, I'm 92, so.
When you were at Chicksands, did you ever go into the Priory?
Well, actually, yes. When I was training, now, my mother, to get away from the bombing in London, went to Stevenage to stay with my three sisters, who were all younger than me. They went to stay so that they could be reasonably near my father. And when the bombing finished, they were going to go back to London. But it happened that my father had been an export manager of a big American dental firm before they called him up. So he had got a friend from the firm, had lived in Stevenage, and his wife was taken ill. And so the gentleman asked my mother if she would go and look after the family while his wife was ill in hospital. So with that, my mother and my three sisters all went to Stevenage to stay at his house. So my father, by this time, was in Chicksands. He was at Chicksands. And he used to, obviously, was able to come over and see my mother. Well, I was, by this time, that's right, I was in the wireless school. And the CO of Chicksands, very nice man, I think was a shepherd, wasn't it? My father thought a lot of him. He said to my father, "We should bring your wife to tea," when he heard that we were there. Well, he said, you know, I think he said, "Well, I've got the family." He said, "Oh, bring them too, you see." So we all went to tea, and I happened to be on leave at the time. You know, it was a bit embarrassing, really, because strictly speaking, I should have been in uniform, but I didn't, because my father said, "No, don't wear uniform." So I was just one of his family, and we all went to tea at Chicksands. So we went into the Priory then, and it was very nice. We had a very nice tea, and one of the lady officers came and spoke to me. She said, "I believe you're in the WAF too, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Oh, well," she said, "that's very nice to meet you. You know, what are you doing?" And I told her. And of course, it was a bit sort of embarrassing, really, because, you know, you didn't know whether you'd salute or not. Anyway, I can't really say any more than that. We had a very pleasant time, and then I went back to Compton Bassett, and my father stayed on, but he did become ill, actually, because he got arthritis.
Rheumatoid arthritis,
that's right, which was diagnosed. Nobody in the family had it, and it was because he'd been in France. Such awful circumstances. They'd been billeted in a derelict police station, I understand, and very damp and very cold. That winter was very cold and windy, and they had to put up with all that and do all their work. I seem to remember him saying he had a little hut out in the field where they worked. He didn't say what he was doing, but somehow I knew they were doing this interception in this little hut in the grounds, and they lived in this derelict police station. I suppose they fed themselves. I suppose they were given money to get themselves food and that. I really don't know. He used to say about the people in the local pub were very, very nice, how lovely they were and kind. And, Monsieur Bretaille, they called him, Mr. Bottle, something like that. They had great fun with them all. And then, of course, the invasion came, so he had to make his way down to Saint-Nazaire.
Yeah. Did he stay in the RAF till the end of the war?
Well, yes, he did, but he was discharged under medical grounds, yes. Yeah. But he did become squadron leader, I think.
Gosh. I don't suppose you have any idea what he was in charge of at Chicksands. Perhaps a load of radio operators? Maybe.
Well, he'd just the watch, I think, the signals watch. Again, they did the same sort of watch as we did. He was just in charge of one section. They had A, B, C and D watches, and he would be in charge of A watch or whatever. Yeah. We had a signals officer in charge of us. I hated him. Dunstan, his name was. But my father said one day, because they went to a reunion of Chicksands a long time after this was, and my father went to, but he recovered sufficiently from the rheumatic arthritis to be able to move, but his hands were very crippled with it. But he was all right. He got about. He wasn't sought to sit around. And he said, I met your officer, Dunstan. He said, didn't much of him. He didn't know anything about him, only that I said I didn't like him. So I think, well, I wasn't just alone. He was very unpleasant. He was a young man who was too well aware of his position and too big an opinion of himself. And he was a nobody. I mean, if he'd had a bit of personality, it would have been better. But he wasn't. So anyway, that was his misfortune, really. Shouldn't be unkind to somebody, should I? But I don't think he's about now anyway. No, if he was, he'd be about 100 and something. Which is doubtful. I don't think there's anything else I can tell you about my father, really.
Yeah. Last question, if you don't mind, is were you very much told to keep it secret what you were doing?
No, nobody ever said. But it's somehow we just knew you didn't talk about it. It just wasn't mentioned. There was no need to. We all knew what we were doing. When I say what we were doing, we all knew our work. There was no need to talk about it, and we knew it was all in code. You didn't know what it was about. There was no way of finding out. We didn't really, not really interested in finding out. It was funny, really. I can say we didn't have the curiosity that people seemed to have, but I don't know about that, really.
Were you surprised 30 years after the war when the story of Bletchley Park came out? Do you remember hearing about that and realising that was what you were connected with?
No, I didn't. I never really dreamed that I was connected with it in any way.
It was only at the beginning of all this that you realised that there was a connection.
Yes, it is. It's only this that I never realised. I knew they were A site, what they were doing, but I had no idea that B site was connected with them at all.
Well, you know, if A site was collecting the signals, intercepting them, you must have been involved with sending them on to where they...
I suppose we must have been. Never dreamed that that's what was happening. I mean, well, I suppose for, I was going to say, reasonably intelligent people, I suppose we were a bit daft not to work it out.
What you've said, it reminds me of what a lot of other people have told me, you know, including people who actually worked at Bletchley Park, is they were told very much not to talk about it.
Yeah.
But people didn't ask them because I think most people at the time, if they were in the services, would not have spoken loosely about what they were doing, whatever they were doing.
Yes.
So I think it was just the way things were.
I dare say it may be that we were told right at the very start, because when you first join up, you attend various lectures on this, that and the other. And it might have been that during one of those lectures, they might have said, well, now you realise that whatever you're doing, you do not talk about it, because there's always these signs about, you know, walls have ears and be like dad, keep mum, and various posters and that, don't talk about what you're doing and things like that, that I suppose unconsciously it was, you don't talk about it, you know. Didn't dawn on me at all. In fact, when I wrote to GCHQ, when I filled in their form that they sent me, or that you sent me, I wrote on it, I really don't think I'm eligible for anything because I really didn't know what I was doing. And I suppose, in a way, that was exactly what they wanted.
Well, you see, there were people at Bletchley Park who didn't know what they were doing. I mean, they did their job well.
Yes.
But there was such a long process of the way these things were dealt with that they knew their bit.
Yes.
And because they didn't talk about it, they didn't know what...
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what you're right. Yeah. And you just didn't realise, no idea that that's what we were doing.
Yeah. In a way, you were lucky because you knew that you were sending and receiving messages because that's what your job was. Whereas a lot of the people on the code-breaking side, they didn't realise it was part of a code-breaking empire, or they might have worked out or be told a little bit. But of course, you know, they weren't doing something that they could compare with jobs in the wider Air Force or Navy or Army, whatever.
It's extraordinary, really, when you think of something with so many people engaged in the work that nothing got out. And it is amazing when you think of the area and the people involved. It is incredible, really. I think that the most incredible thing is that people don't realise just what an amazing thing it was that the Germans really didn't know anything about it. I find that so staggering, really.
Well, it's thanks to talking with people like yourself that we're getting the full picture of what happened at Bletchley Park and all the places without which Bletchley Park couldn't have done its job. So I think perhaps we'll call it a day now. I think it's about time you have a well-earned rest. But are there any last points you haven't told us or any questions you'd like to ask?
I can't really think.
And then we can always turn it back on again if something crops
just
up.
Just as you like.
But just to say thank you very, very much for this. It's really interesting.
It's my pleasure.
We've got three for the price of one with your husband and dad, well, so that's great.
I'm very pleased. I could do something.
Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.